Hi, I'm Eric Topol, editor-in-chief of Medscape, and I'm really delighted to have the chance to speak with Lucy Kalanathi, who is an internist on the clinical faculty at Stanford and has co-authored a book, this book, which is a phenomenal book, When Breath Becomes Air. So we're going to be talking about Lucy's career, the book that she that Paul wrote, that she wrote the epilogue, and what it means for as an inspiration for medicine, for people facing cancer, terminal illness, and all sorts of things. So welcome, Lucy.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. I know that you have had a busy time recently with the release of this book, and that as a very young man, as your husband, Paul, who died of lung cancer, and I would maybe just start off with, you all met at Yale Med School in the first year. What was it like? What was it that brought you two together?
That's right. We met in 2003 at Yale as first-year students. The literal thing that brought us together is that there's a hunger and homelessness fundraiser at Yale Med. Every year, the students run it, and my name was picked out of a raffle to go on a date with Paul. So that happened, and then we were never apart after that. So,
really? So this was one of the love at first sight things, really?
Kind of.
Did you ever think that you'd wind up with a physician as a spouse? I mean, is that, you know, being a doctor yourself?
Right. I never thought about it. You know, you sort of make these decisions as you go through your life. And for me, I thought I was going to be an engineer or a math teacher. And then those sort of combined, right, the personal and scientific to bring me into medicine. And then I was really drawn to Paul in medical school because he was also sort of a mix of a really literary, philosophical guy who was coming into medicine for the really human, deep part of what it means to be in medicine. And that was why he was so appealing.
Well, there's very different and complementary aspects of your personalities. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the book he alluded to a moment when you were reading about a cardiogram, someone with ventricular fibrillation, and then you started crying because you realized that person had to have died from that. And it just kind of, in just a very brief description, it gave a window to your caring and emotional self. And it just seemed like, whereas Paul is a kind of deep thinker with the background of having not only gone to Stanford, but also with the extra master's in English there, and then to Cambridge with the philosophy and science, all this extra stuff, that he really was into this deep thinking stuff, particularly, I guess, about the meaning of life. Is that, did he talk much about that, or just thought about it?
Yeah, he was sort of talking and thinking about it all the time, and not necessarily explicitly, you know, like quoting philosophers or talking about the books he loved, but just the way in which he was so engaged in life. You know, he was, somebody asked me, was he always really intense? You can tell in his writing that he's a real striver and very deeply thoughtful. And I said, yeah, he was always very intense, but it wasn't necessarily that he was always very serious. He was just as likely to, you know, stay up all night drinking whiskey with an old friend. And that's a form of intensity too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like
sure.
He was just really, but really alive.
He could have a work hard, play hard
yeah,
type of thing.
That's right.
Yeah, no, it's impressive. Yeah. But what I'm trying to get to understand was that before he ever got to the point of being diagnosed with lung cancer, it seemed like when he wrote the retrospective that this was a thing. You're understanding not just the meaning of life, but through death. That is what more of a challenge, acid test, to understand one's life than having to face death. So whereas most people don't really think so much about this, this is something that he seemed to really cue into long before he took ill.
That's right. Yeah, it's even as a young person, he was very interested in literature and philosophy as a way to get at the question of what makes us human, what does it mean to be human? And then, like you say, thinking about death, how do we make sense of our lives and build value despite the fact that we are mortal? And he surprised himself by entering medicine, and ultimately it was because he wanted to be face-to-face with people making those really tough decisions and sort of approaching their mortality directly. And then when he himself was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer when he was 36 and a chief resident in neurosurgery at Stanford, those questions were no longer theoretical. They were deeply emotional and existential for him. And it's funny because as he's writing the book, he's talking about these questions about dying, right? How do I spend my time? But really, those are questions about living.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, it's just the theme of meaning for life comes through, shines through in an extraordinary way. So he then, you both finish at Yale. You do different residencies, you at UCSF and he at Stanford, I guess. He goes on to be ultimately in neurosurgery. Mm-hmm. But the first part of the book where he's recapping what this kind of led to, there's a lot of deaths in there. You know, he focuses, he gives the most elegant description of what it's like to deal with cadavers that I've ever read. No less, he talks about his first deaths that he encountered as a trainee and preemies that died and other patients. He had a list of patients. I mean, he really goes through these, had such a big impact on him. So it was really fascinating. And even the loss of his co-resident friend,
right,
I guess, Jeff.
From suicide,
yeah,
that's right.
From suicide. Incredible. So he took all these lessons from, it seemed like. So then now he's well into the neurosurgery residency. He's not well, but you don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, what happens?
Right. So for a period of about 5 months before his diagnosis, he'd been losing weight and started to have very severe back pain. And it's funny because he'd just come off his research years. He re-entered, the work of a chief resident. And so he's on his feet 14 hours a day, and he's skipping lunch. And, you know, as an intern, he had lost 15 pounds. And so this seemed like the same thing being repeated, right? Like, okay, your back aches because you're doing these, you know, long spinal surgeries, et cetera. And then he started to have night sweats. And he got some lab tests that were a little off, and he got a back x-ray that looked okay, but things were kind of continued to get worse and worse. And ultimately, he had a chest x-ray, and it showed nodules throughout throughout his chest and throughout his lungs. And it was clear to both of us in that moment what that likely was, and then it was confirmed on a CT that we looked at together. He pulled it up on the screen, and we sort of, there was no... it was a really unmediated way to receive that news, you know, to look at his scan with our own eyes, and that was the way in which we sort of received the metastatic cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, I know, and here it is, this pretty unique situation of such a young guy, a doctor who'd dealt with a lot of brain tumors in his neurosurgery world, you as a physician, and also, I think, now the spouse, and having to deal with this immense issue. And fortunately, I guess, he tested positive for EGFR mutation and got at least initially a very nice response to treatment for Tarceva. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. He was on erlotinib Tarceva. And it really brought him back to life. It was actually quite amazing to see. I think both of us, when he was diagnosed, thought he might even die that year. He ended up living 22 months, which is... probably around the median survival for stage 4 cancer diagnosis. But that first year was such high quality time because the therapy had so few side effects. So he ultimately went back to work initially as a neurosurgeon. He really wanted to finish residency. And he was always sort of working toward the best case scenario. So, you know, he knew that on erlotinib, maybe he would live a decade. And he said, you know, if I don't become a neurosurgeon, I'm going to be really mad if I live 10 years. So the best case scenario was that, and he set down the neurosurgical path again. And then when erlotinib failed, the prognosis shrinks, the treatment becomes more debilitating. And that was when he started to really focus on writing as his top priority. And we were also having a baby at that time.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So... you know, he. What I was also struck by is that here he's doing his neurosurgery residency, and it seemed like he had done it, and he still wanted to make sure that he fulfilled every last requirement. Wouldn't they give him a pass? I mean, you know, he's been treated with lung cancer, and he went through all this stuff. Or did he not even try to say, you know, didn't I do enough to get, you know, to graduate?
He didn't Yeah, you're right. So he basically had met the technical requirements to graduate, but there's this moment, and he describes it in the book, where he was sort of doing like shift work in a way. He would come in and he would take care of patients, but he wasn't rounding. He was just in the OR. And again, that was to sort of meet the technical bar.
But after all these years of doing everything, I mean, 36 hours in the operating room continuously and all this other stuff that he had done, right?
Right. And he also started saying later and later, because the thing that was the richest for him was to, you know, the people that he was taking care of, to be shepherding people through this difficult time, and not just being technically excellent, but being connected to his patients. And so that was what brought him enough meaning that he could suffer through. I mean, he was in pain and he was nauseated, and we did a lot of work with his medications to try to control his symptoms so that he could be focused on his patients and what he wanted to focus on.
So when along the way did he say, I'm going to do a book, I'm going to write a book? When did he have this epiphany?
So it was really, I can't believe it ended up working out, because he'd always thought he'd be a writer. He's a really talented writer. And and he loved it. He loved writing. And so he wrote that essay in the New York Times, How Long Have I Got Left? And he wrote it on a plane flight, and he wanted a way to work through his, you know, the challenge of facing uncertainty. Even when you have a terminal illness, you're still also coping with uncertainty about when and what and what does the future hold? And so he wrote that essay. He sent it to two friends. The first friend wrote back and said, this essay isn't that great yet. It's, you know, you buried your lead, and it's not very funny, and you're kind of making three different points at once. And the other friend said, I forwarded this straight to the op-ed desk at the New York Times. And they, thank goodness, and they ended up publishing it, you know, almost without any edits.
Yeah.
And then he was approached by agents and editors after that, which was literally a dream come true.
So that's really the op-ed led to this. He wasn't thinking of a book at that time.
No.
But with him being so sick, it must have been really hard. And, you know, you get into some of the things you had to do to try to get him supported to be able to write. He obviously had immense talent. And this book, as Abraham Verghese says in the prologue, he says, it took my breath away to read this, which is true, actually. Anybody who reads this book. In fact, it's no surprise when I first read it that this would become the number one book, nonfiction, you know, everywhere. It has had perhaps more impact than a book than I can remember, actually. Mm-hmm. So you then had to finish the book because he was so sick that he could only get so far. He tried, I guess. And now that wasn't your thing, I guess, to be a writer, particularly at this rarefied level.
Right.
So how did you deal with that?
Yeah. So there was more he would have liked to write. But when he died, the book was a manuscript on his computer. It was like an open Word document. And he died on a Monday night around 9 p.m. And then 12 hours later, I was on the phone with his agent and editor saying, how can we still make this happen? And he'd wanted it to happen. He'd secured the book deal. He was totally thrilled. And then when he knew he was dying and he couldn't work on it anymore, he said, can you please try to publish this in some way? And we didn't even know if it would be a series of essay articles or could it still be a book. It took a lot of work through the year of 2015 to put it all together. And, you know, it was copy edited, and we supplemented it with other writing that he had done. So interestingly, here's an example. He had written in brackets, insert anatomy lab essay. And that essay about the anatomy lab he'd written as a medical student.
Oh,
so there
okay.
were other pieces of writing that made their way in to, you know, make sure that it could be a book. It's all his writing. And choosing the cover and like a lot of different decisions, I had to make those for him and then write the epilogue.
He had come up with the title?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is the title just couldn't be more.
It's beautiful, right?
Yeah,
it's
really.
From a little Elizabethan poem by Greville that starts out by saying, you that seek what life is in death, now find it air that once was breath. Yeah. And he was reading, he had this little volume of poetry that he read when he was sick, and there are these amazing poems like The Glories of Our Blood and State by James Shirley is another example. And he's reading a lot about mortality and death. And when he read that little poem, he said, I think I have the title for my book. And he has this little star next to that line. It's beautiful.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, by the way, you touched on the fact that there was another side of him, that not just a deep thinker, serious philosopher into the meaning of life, but also a jokester and mm-hmm. a person with a lot of humor. It struck me so much when he said after to the Emma, the oncologist, after the diagnosis, he says, "Can I start smoking now?" Or when he said, when you had your in vitro fertilization, you had the blastocyst, and he said, "The baby's got your cell membrane," yeah. or something. I mean, you know, stuff that, yeah, just amazing. So he is essentially, because of what you've done together, the book, and then you're capping it off with this amazing epilogue, have really immortalized his life. Mm-hmm. And it seems as though what has happened here is that so many people have read this and been inspired to be able to face death, mm-hmm. but also to have make the most of one's life as possible, to be, you know, brave and courageous. So where do you take this now? This is a unparalleled story in so many respects, and you're young and you've got a medical career. And how do you integrate what's happened here with your arc in medicine?
And integrate is a great word, I think. It's funny because I thought after Paul died, you know, I'll work really hard to make sure this book happens, and then I'll go back to my job.
Sure.
And I'm an internist, and I was at this great research institute at Stanford that thinks about healthcare value. And then with the response to the book, I've been able to enter this national conversation about end-of-life care, which I think is so compelling and so amazing to me, and sort of it's a way in which this experience stretches forward into the future for me to be thinking about this as a widow and a former caregiver and a doctor all put together. And it's funny because I don't know where it's going to lead me, but I'm also much more comfortable tolerating uncertainty, you know, since everything that happened with Paul's illness. It's sort of like, I think in medicine, you get on this path and you feel like you're going to be on this one path that you can see stretching out, or you think you need a credential for every single thing you say, you know, and instead speaking about this personal experience has taught me something else about expertise and authenticity and making a difference, you know. So well, it's just been amazing
for
me.
There is some stuff beyond evidence-based medicine,
yeah.
you know, and what you're getting at here, which is something that particularly in our society has had such a difficult time groping
right.
with. And you've got some invaluable lessons and experience here to get out. So this has been, I think, for me, a great opportunity to really get in your head as to what all happened during a really horrific experience
yeah.
that has been turned into something that is not just instructive, but as I mentioned, highly inspirational. And I really, you know, just give so much credit to you. For many people who read the book come out and say, well, what a courageous man and what a brave person mm-hmm. to look death in the eye, mm-hmm. as he articulates. But equally so is what you've done and continue to do to take this mission forward, that all that you learned to help impart to others. So thank you for what you've done.
We're
very fortunate to have a physician in our midst who can help take this forward. And this book is one I think every medical student will have to read as part of the curriculum, but it's much bigger than that. It's not just about doctors learning about the care of their patients, but, you know, all people could benefit. So that means you need about 7 billion books translated into a lot of different languages, so maybe that'll happen. So thanks, Lucy, for joining us on Medscape One-on-One. And thanks to all of you for your attention to a really interesting conversation with really a remarkable person and couple. And if you haven't read this book, you ought to, because if you haven't, you need to be inspired. Thanks very much.